Morning.
Morning.
So this morning I'd like to talk about a quote from my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And this quote is very simple. It's, we do Hinayana practice with a Mahayana attitude. And I'm actually going to change the quote so that it doesn't disparage the elders by saying, we do a Theravadin practice with a Mahayana attitude. We do a Theravadin practice with a Mahayana attitude. Well, what's that all about? Well, Theravadin practice, that's the practice of the elders. That's a practice that comes from the Pali scriptures. That's considered dualistic practice. That is, I'm me and you're you. The floor's here and the ceiling's there. And I want to improve my life. I want to have a better relationship with you and you and you. So I do dualistic practice. Dualistic means there are two of us. There's always two of us, or three of us, or eight of us. I do a practice to try to feel more connected to you, and to try to let go of all my sense of territoriality and defensiveness, and just be with you. But I do it with a Mahayana attitude, with a non-dualistic attitude. That's an attitude based on non-separation. Instead of me and you, it's this. Instead of floor and ceiling, it's this. Instead of lake and sky, it's all this. All this. Not separate. Not separate. Nothing separate. So that's the attitude that my first teacher was talking about. The attitude. So I want to talk a little bit about a few dualistic practices and some non-dualistic attitude. And they won't be new to most of you. So I'll talk about briefly about four dualistic practices, four practices we do to try to get more calmed down, more connected to each other, more connected to this big world, those people who we don't feel connected to in this big world. First is sitting meditation, right? We're the Zen school. We're the sitting meditation school of Buddhism. We do sitting meditation, and we try to do it every day, even if it's just for a few minutes. And we can do it in a sitting posture at best. We can even do it down by the lake if we don't get distracted every day. Well, for a while, for maybe another couple of weeks. Unless you're really into ordeal type of dualistic practice, which is part of our practice too, actually, ordeal type of dualistic practice. Sitting every day and then immersing yourself sometimes in stillness. We call it retreat. One of our retreats, or a retreat at Common Ground or some other Zen center, or your own retreat in the woods, in close to nature. So that's sitting meditation. It's a dualistic practice. We do that meditation to still our minds and to open up, feel connected. Second dualistic practice is meditation in action, in our activity. Whatever activity we're doing, we try to be there with it. We try to be there with it. We bring our attention to it. Whether we're drinking a glass of water or listening to someone who's upset, we try to be there. It's an effort we make to try to connect to them. They're separate than us. We're trying to connect with them. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we can use tools in our daily life to help us. We can use our breathing to help us. It's the the base level of health, our breathing. We start to get agitated on the highway when someone's maybe cut in front of us. We notice our breathing. We come back to our breathing. We anchor ourselves in our breathing so we can be present and not just tossed away by our anger, by our misery, by whatever. We stay grounded in our breathing. So no matter what is going on outside, we're practicing a dualistic practice to try to stay with this, using our breathing or using something we say to ourselves, like when someone cuts us off, rather than swearing at them. But if we're swearing at them, we just notice that. And then we come back to our breathing. We come back to something that we want to repeat to ourselves to help us get in touch with our breathing. It could be anything. Anything. So those are the first two practices that are sort of core to our practice of the elders. Our Theravadin practice of the elders. Meaning this is what if you go back and read the Pali canons, this is what these guys and women were doing. This is what they were doing and what we're doing. This third one is cultivating compassion. Compassion is something we have to cultivate. We have to cultivate. It's fine to talk about compassion, to say compassion, but it's something we work on in our heart. We pay attention to our heart. We pay attention to our heart. When somebody is mean to us or disses us, we feel hurtness in our hearts. We feel agitation. Can we have compassion for our heart and also for them? When they're dissing us, it means they're suffering. They're suffering. That's why they diss us. They wouldn't diss us if they weren't suffering. Can we just practice compassion? Just practice imagining what it's like for them without getting tripping out? Just imagining in our heart what it's like to them to be so aggravated that they're giving us the finger or whatever they're doing? Can we just do it? That's cultivation of compassion. We do that. It's a good practice. It's an aspiration. It's not just a passive emotion. We aspire to it. We may have goofed on it yesterday, but we aspire to it today. We may have goofed on it in this moment. We aspire to it on the next moment. It's a dualistic practice. There's me and there's you. There's your feelings and there's my feelings. I have to pay attention to my feelings and your feelings. And by working to express my compassion toward you who have wronged me, what did you do to wrong me? Well, could have done anything, right? I realize our connectedness. And I feel at peace. Take strength to do this. These dualistic practices take strength. But we have that strength. We all have that strength. The fourth practice is simplifying our lives and slowing our lives down. Simplifying and slowing down. You read this all the time in the teachings of the elders. Simplifying and slowing down. So, as many of you know, I've been gone to California for 4 weeks, reading from my book, Nothing Holy About It. Well, I like to check and see how my book is doing on Amazon, how the sales are doing. That's a dualistic practice, by the way. One that I enjoy. I like to check. Well, how's it doing? Well, sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. Sometimes it's in between. It's all relative, right? You go on Amazon, you can see what numerical rating your book is. So what's my numerical rating for Zen philosophy? For some reason, they put it into Zen philosophy. I don't know. I don't think it was philosophical, but I guess it is. So what's the number for Zen philosophy? Oh, it's down to 50. That's pretty good. Oh, A. Almost last night it was at 150. 150. Oh, geez. You know, right? Dualist. Well, we just notice and we pay attention. We just notice and we pay attention. I don't have to get wigged out about it. Kind of fun. Kind of fun. Oh, maybe 1,000, maybe 10,000. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, the first three under Zen philosophy, repeatedly for the whole summer, have been the life-changing magic of tidying up. The life-changing... Did you notice that, Wanda? The life-changing magic of tidying... What is that? That's Zen philosophy? And it has a Japanese author. So last night I was at home listening with my family, and my daughter-in-law was talking about this book, The Life-Changing Effect of Tidying Up. And I said, what's that? I said, that book is crowding out all the good books on Zen. And she said, well, Tim, this is the deal. She said, it's written by a Japanese person who claims to be a Zen person, and it's about all the things that we own. And it's about, she said, it's about taking time with everything you own and looking at it, being with it, and saying to yourself, does this make me feel good? Does this make me feel happy? And if it doesn't, getting rid of it. So it's a whole book on that. And it's the first three, number one and number two and number three under Zen philosophy on Amazon. So simplifying our lives. A whole book that evidently the whole country is reading on how to simplify our lives. Very simple. Very simple. These pants that I have on, do they make me feel happy? If not, I might as well take them off. Well, maybe I should pay attention to whether they make you feel happy. So simplifying. We don't need all this stuff. We don't need 32 channels on television. We don't need to continually be texting, do we? We can turn our iPhones off once in a while, can't we? Just once in a while. Just be with what is. We can do this stuff. Simplifying our life helps us. It helps us a lot. Helps us a lot. And slowing our lives down. Mindful consumption means, well, that's still for simplifying, mindful consumption. What do we really want to take in to this body, to this mind, to these ears? What makes us feel connected and what doesn't? What just stuffs us up so that we don't feel anything? Noticing that. Mindful consumption. Mindful conversations. How many times do we have to go over the same thing with our partner? 32 times. Do we really need to do that? Really? With our friend? Really need to do that? Is that mindful conversation? I don't think so. I don't think so. So paying attention and then slowing our lives down. We know what it's like in the 21st century. We know. I remember being in the fifth grade. I've mentioned this before. In the fifth grade, my teacher said, in the 21st century, people will only be working 15 to 20 hours a week because we have all of this material wealth, we're interconnected, and there will be no reason. So the average length of the job will be 15 to 20 hours a week, and we'll all be happy. Right. What happened? We went the other way. We went the other way. Because we're afraid. Because we're afraid. Because we're nervous. Because we're agitated. We went the other way. As a culture. So we sped up. We've sped up our lives. No wonder everyone's now interested in meditation. So many people are interested now. But how many people are really doing it? But if they're interested, that's okay. With a little encouragement, they'll start doing it. So I was just out in Silicon Valley where I grew up. But before it was Silicon Valley, I grew up. You never heard of Silicon Valley. All we knew was streams and polywogs and catching toads and going biking. That's all I knew. Later it became Silicon Valley. So I was out there, and just before I went out there, I read a critique of Amazon, the front page of the New York Times, a several-page critique. Some of you read it, because you're... And I thought, my goodness, I don't even know if I want to go to Silicon Valley, because the article about Amazon was about how driven people are, and how people are expected to work 70, 80 hours a week and not take any vacation. And if they don't work 70, 80 hours a week, they're not okay. They're kind of dissed from the system. It's a badge of honor not to take your vacation. It shows you show loyalty to your employer not by taking your vacation, not by wasting time by meditating. So I saw that. But then I went out and I spent time with my friend Norman Fisher, Zen teacher Norman Fisher, who's going to be coming here this spring. And I was telling him about the Amazon. He said, yeah, it's like that. He said, but you know, not all the Silicon Valley organizations are like that. He said, take Google, for instance. He said, in Google, the fifth day of the week, their professional employees are encouraged to do something to nurture them. It should be related to their vocation, but they have the whole day free to do something to nurture them. And he said, furthermore, I work with Google to develop something called Search Inside Yourself, which I got the book. I haven't seen it yet, but some of you guys may have seen it. One of the head people at Google really is interested in meditation. And so he developed a whole meditation protocol for Google employees with my friend Norman, and which is used at Google now. And so there's a meditation room at Google, which is not just a fake room, but which people are encouraged to go to, and they have time to go to. So the difference, and I'm probably oversimplifying the difference between Google and Amazon. You can probably know much more than I do, but there's the potential, even in the corporate world, for us to just search inside ourselves, just come back to being with this. Slow down, slow down, slow down, and not give in to this frenetic pace that seems to be dominant in our culture and in our lives. And even if we say it's not dominant in our lives, it because we do our meditation every day and we don't let it affect us, it affects us. It affects us. It affects all of us. So, simplifying our lives, slowing down our lives, and then the last one, the last dualistic practice, aspiration. And aspiration is dualistic because we aspire to realize something that we haven't realized, or to know something, or feel connected to something. So the aspiration to realize our stillness, our Buddha nature, our open nature, our available nature. Just aspire to realize that, aspire to manifest that, to be with it, that stillness, regardless of where we are. Just through our simple act of breathing, meditating, and being. That's an aspiration. Aspire to not be dominated by the little guy in here who's always pissing and moaning. Not be dominated by her. Not be dominated by her. But see beyond her. Take care of her. Take care of her. She's always in here. But see beyond her. See through her. Experience this, the wonderful interconnectedness. It's always here. That's an aspiration. An aspiration to know that this little wave is the ocean. To feel that this little wave is the ocean. And to act in that way. To act in it. So those are five practices of the elders. Five practices of the elders. And we are now becoming the elders. We are the elders as we do this practice. We do this practice. So that's the Theravada practice, the dualistic practice. Well, now let's get into the Mahayana attitude, okay? Let's get into the non-dualistic attitude. So I've got this in three different sections here. First section is being nobody. Being nobody. We're supposed to be focused on becoming more important, or becoming kinder, or becoming better versions of ourselves. Ourselves, if they are pretty shitty. We want to become better versions of ourselves. Don't we? Don't you? That's up to it. If you don't, I don't know. You're a very unusual person. So we notice that. We notice that. We notice how programmed we are to working on improving the me-ness, the timness. Working on improving that. Program not just to be somebody, but to be the right kind of somebody. I mean, a Zen teacher who doesn't get pissed at his students. A Zen teacher shouldn't get pissed at his students, right? He's the Zen teacher. That's the little me that wants to be better. That's dualistic. That's dualistic, because the little me looks at the world and wants to be better. But actually, what about the attitude that we're nobody? That we never were anybody. We never will be anybody. Because this is just a little made-up guy in here, a little made-up girl in here. Made up by our culture, sustains us culturally, interpersonally, but it's made up. Because there isn't anybody here, really. There's no one inside. There's just this interchange of wonderful energy, of wonderful life. Right here. It's always interchanging, it's always flowing. Right? So stop using life. This is the attitude of Mahayana, to stop using life to validate me, 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 to fit life into our storyline. We can have stories. It's wonderful to have stories, but our attitude is not to try to, big attitude is not to fit life into our storyline, because life is life. Life is life. Our attitude is to stop relating to life as either sustaining or endangering me. If we just see that this me is made up stuff, then life can be life, and there can be stories told about life, but there's not this huge division and all this arguing inside about who we should be and who we have been and who we might be and who we weren't and who we'll never be, and I might as well just give up or whatever. Try harder or give up or do both. So there's a freshness and openness that comes when we just see that our me identity is made up stuff. Just made up stuff. And we feel connected. We feel connected. So when I was in California giving my I was in California with my book. I just talked about that. I was reading at all the Zen centers from my book, which is actually not my book. It's Wanda and my book, because she wrote it and I give the talks. So I just need to continually point that out. Anyway, I was at Green Gulch Zen Monastery. I was at all the places in my home where I grew up, including Green Gulch, giving a talk there. And that's in Mill Valley, California, right near the Pacific Ocean. So Juan and I were walking down to the ocean, and who do we meet on the trail coming up from the ocean? Well, Reb Anderson, who's been the head at Green Gulch for a long, long time. He's not the head anymore. He's just he's there, but he's not formally the head. You don't need to formally be the head of anything because you're nobody, right? You are. You're the head of everything because you're nobody. You're nobody. You're absolutely no one. Everything else is delusion from the Mahayana point of view. But that's joyful. It's not negative. It's joyful. Anyway, we ran into him. We were leaving, and he was coming down, and he was there with his wife, whom I never met, and he said they were going swimming. And we said, swimming? I said, swimming? This is, I don't know if you know the Pacific Ocean in September. Swimming, I said. I said, do you have a wetsuit? He said, no, I don't have a wetsuit. He said, but I've gotten used to the water. I've gotten used to the water. So, is it possible for us to get used to being nobody? Just to diving into this? Just dive into this ocean. It's right here. Just dive into it. Without a wetsuit? Can we do it without a wetsuit? Can we experience life directly? Just directly? Just feel it as it is? The weather's cold sometimes, but just feeling it makes us alive. Makes us alive. The wetsuit keeps us from feeling directly. All this chattering keeps us from just feeling, just opening our pores. Mahayana attitude. Mahayana attitude. We experience some wonder. Some wonder. And in fact, we're reborn continually. It's not you got reborn, you got enlightened. It's here. It's here. You didn't get anything. You're nobody. Nada. Nada de particular. We believe we need the story of Tim in order for our experience of life to continue. But life continues without Tim, without this little guy chattering. It continues. And there's a liberation, there's a lightness when our constraints and separations don't dominate everything. Without anybody to defend, without anything to uphold, we're free to be who we are. So, this is something I talked about a lot, my teachers talked about a lot, but it's not talking about it, it's experiencing it yourself. Just realizing it yourself as your attitude, your basic attitude. Doesn't mean you don't do the Theravada practices, you do them with that attitude, much as possible with that attitude. Without the story of me, in one chapter in my book, I talk about the veils, the varanas in Buddhism, the varanas, the veils that cover the heart, the veils that cover the mind, the veils that cover the body. These are the somebody veils, the veils of somebody. Meister Eckhart, I talked about last time, talks about the skins that cover the heart mind. Skins, veils, baggage. It's all this little guy in here who is so frantic trying to get everything fixed. But if we just see him, if we just are kind to him, we see through him and beyond him into right this, just this, just this. We drop the story of our me and what our life is supposed to be. It comes back, but we learn how to drop it. But who drops it? Do we drop it? It drops itself. Drops itself. So I tell the story in my book, which I pulled here before, because all the stories I tell in my book I've told at least probably 3 to 8 times here before. I tell the story in my book of being in meditation retreats at the Zen monastery that I used to attend when I was young, called Tassajara, where in California. Coming back to San Francisco, where I live, after being in several very long retreats and really doing a lot of this Theravadan practice, just the meditation and the simplifying. Of course, when you live in a monastic situation, you're forced to simplify. It's very good. But we have to do it on our own. It's very good that we do it on our own. Anyway, coming back and being in a very sensitive, open state, and going to the De Young Museum in San Francisco, which is the Asian museum that in those days had the best Asian art, I think, in the United States. And going into the museum right after the retreat at the Zen monastery, and going up to the third floor of the museum where the Theravada, where the Thai collection was, the Thai collection of Buddha statues, seeing the Buddha statues up there, and noticing the vacancy in their eyes, and being just sort of taken with that vacancy. And going down to the second floor and seeing the Chinese Buddhas, and very different stylistically, but the same vacancy in their eyes, the same openness, the same stillness. Going down to the first floor, the Japanese Buddhas, very different stylistically, the same vacancy there. And then feeling that vacancy inside myself, feeling it. So there was nobody there. And then my body started to freeze. My body started to cramp up and completely disoriented and staggered out to the bus. Went to the Zen Center. Knocked on this door. Suzuki came down. I told him what was going on with all of this vacancy, all of this sense of openness, and my body just frozen. And all he did was say, "Let's have a cup of tea." And he asked me about the statues. He said, "Let's have a cup of tea." I had a cup of tea, and I went home. But when I had a cup of tea, there was no I having a cup of tea. It was just having a cup of tea. Does there have to be an I when you're just having a cup of tea? Does there have to be, you guys? How about just having a cup of tea with no I at all? Just the tea? Just the pleasure of the person's company? Just putting it in your mouth? Just noticing the quality of the teacup? Does there need to be an I? Then going home on the bus? Does there need to be an I going home? Body mind knows how to go home on the bus. You know? Just being on the bus. Just having dinner. Just going to bed. Do you need an eye for that stuff? You guys? We need an eye for some things, but we don't need it for most of the stuff that it interferes with, right? We just don't need it. So then we have energy. Energy that's dissipated, depleted on this little eye cruising around all the time, making a mess of everything. And we have some spontaneity. So, but this is a Mahayana attitude, not a Mahayana practice. So if you try to turn it into a practice, then you'll become a shrinking violet. Oh, I'm nobody. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to be good. I'm going to sacrifice everything. That's not nobody. That's a new somebody who is nobody. Lots of religious people are into somebodies who are nobodies. Lots of Buddhists and Christians and Hindus. So be careful of that. Notice that. Notice that when you've turned it into a practice rather than just an open attitude. Then it just creates more buzz, more havoc. So that's the first Mahayana attitude, or the first way in which I'm talking about Mahayana attitude. Second, what you guys already know, be in the moment. But the caveat is, be in the moment whether you like the moment or not. Be in the moment whether you like it or not. Wanda and I were out in California, and I don't know why I ever left California. I left 45 years ago, but jeez. Because it's so beautiful. We were by the ocean. We were in the mountains. We were in the Golden Gate Bridge. I called my wife and I said, "Oh, geez, it's beautiful here. Well, why did we ever leave?" And she said, "Well, it was your idea." And she said something else too. I don't know if I'm going to. I don't think I'll tell you now. What she said was, "It was your idea, but I've learned better now than to follow your ideas." That's what she said. "I've learned better now."
So, close to nature, being in the moment. Nature, when we're close to nature, it helps us be in the moment. Now, this is not true for everyone. Often people who live close to nature get very habituated to it, and they just growl about it. But with our beginner's mind, if we're close to nature, just the beauty of a sunset, just a lake, the ripples on a lake, really help us with our Mahayana attitude of being in the moment. They help us. Just one tree in the backyard helps us. Look at the leaves. Helps us. But what about when it's a bad moment? What about when it's a bad moment? What about when it's a storm in nature and we don't have any extra gear? We're just out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night with no extra gear. That's a bad moment. Can we be in that bad moment? Yes, we can. We can be in that bad moment. We can just be there. I started going out to homeless camps in my job, which I retired from about 15 years ago. Many of those moments were bad moments. I was scared to go out. I didn't know if the people would be drinking or if they'd be passing out drugs. People who took me out said they'd give me cold coffee to drink. I thought, God, drink that cold coffee? What's in it? But when I did it, I tried to be in the moment. Tried to be in the moment. So we're so good at being present in the moments we lack. And we make an assumption that by agreeing to be present in what we call the bad moments, we're giving up all efforts to change them. But we're not. We're not. Going out to a homeless camp, bad moments. But feeling those moments, feeling what those homeless people are up against, feeling, getting what they're dealing with, so that we can help them change their lives. So we can help them change their lives. That's part of it, being in the moment. It doesn't mean we don't try to change. We don't want stuff. Of course we do. That's part of the full moment. Just embracing it. Just embracing it. That's the non-dual attitude. That's the Mahayana attitude. Agreeing to be present in our hard moments is simply agreeing that what's happening is happening. Agreeing that what's happening is happening. Yes, this is hard. This is hard to be here. To be here in nature when there's a huge hurricane and I don't even have a coat. This is hard. But I can be here. I can be here because this is what is. This is what is. So when I was in California, I wanted to see the first Zen center that I used to practice in San Francisco, which was in a Jewish synagogue. The Japanese have bought a Jewish synagogue to bring their Japanese teacher to help them with the ceremonies, and we just leached off them in the Japanese community by doing meditation on the second floor. They didn't come to the meditation. We did it on the second floor. But my teacher ministered to them and to us both. One of the things he did was go to the Japanese movies with them that were shown in the auditorium of the Jewish synagogue, which is now a senior citizen center. We went over to see it, and now it's a senior citizen center. And I showed Wanda where the auditorium was in the back. Well, I showed her where it should have been. We didn't go in the back of the senior citizen center. That's where they showed the movies. And they showed Class B or C or D or E or F Japanese samurai movies. A lot of guts. And there was a big poster which welcomed me every morning when I'd go to meditation on the side by the auditorium of the next movie coming up. The samurai, you know, stabbing people and damsels in distress. But my teacher went to see those movies every week because that's what he did with the Japanese people. The Japanese people like to see those movies. But I went to, and those of you know this story, many of you, because it's in my book and I'm talking about it. I went to North Beach to see the good movies, to see the Francois Truffaut movies, right? The French movies. In those days, the independent movies seemed to be all made by French people. That's not the case anymore. And so, one morning, on a Sunday morning, my teacher saw him on Saturday night. I said to him, you have to see those every night, every Saturday night? He said, yes. And I said, do you like any of them? And he said, I like them all. I like them all. And I thought, first saw he just totally unsophisticated. But later I realized he was saying something to help me. Because all my images were negative. All my movies were bad when I was sitting. Or we could say 65% of my movies were bad when I was sitting. It was a time my sitting was not going well. One bad movie after another. One bad image after another. I didn't want to be in those moments. I only wanted to be in the good movie moments. I only wanted to be in the North Beach movie moments. The Francois Truffaut movies. Instead, I was in these awful samurai movies. I was starring in them, right in the middle of a retreat, for the whole retreat. So that was the teaching. I like them all. I can be in this moment. I may hate them, but I can just watch them. They're not me. They're just images. They're just feelings about images. That's all. Just feelings about images. Giving up the fight with what it's supposed to be and the idea that what's happening shouldn't be happening. Experiencing wholeness, completeness. Just where we are. Just where we are. Being right here, planting our feet here, planting our butt here. That's where we can change. But only by being here in it. Released from the primary cause of suffering, which is trying to be somewhere else. Self-compassion. Diving into the whole of what is without a wetsuit. Without a wetsuit, without fins, without skin. Embracing what's happening, how we feel about it, how we wish it weren't so, how we're going to try and change it all at once. All at once. Watching the movie without being consumed by it. And offering our kindness to this predicament that we have. In life, our kindness to this negative reaction we have to all these images we don't like. Just being with it means offering our kindness. And the last one, the last Mahayana attitude, is embracing our suffering. Embracing our suffering. Just embracing it. I've talked about that before. My teacher did. So there was one of the teachers out that we visited with out in California. I saw that he'd written a book, and I opened his book and was reading it, and the last chapter of the book was about his relationship with his teacher. And he talked about being Eno. The Eno at the Zen Center is the person who's in charge of everything. All the practice, the greeters, the people who do the bells, the everything, everything. Everything except the food. And that's a hard job. And this person was appointed as Eno when he was just starting to practice. His teacher said, oh, you can be in charge of everything. So he thought, oh, great. And he's a kind of an obsessive compulsive guy. So he was really trying to get everything down, really trying to organize everyone. Trying to listen to everyone's needs and get everyone to do all these different jobs. Any of you been Eno here? Know what it's like. It's not easy. Not easy. Wanda is in her second stint as Eno, so she gets extra nobody credit for that. And then he said, the more he tried to organize, the more he tried to get it set up, the more it seemed to not work. And the more he suffered, the more he suffered. And then at some point, his teacher said to him, his teacher who never said anything to him, never gave him, said anything, said, well, you can just let it all fall apart. And his teacher seemed to be being serious. But that helped him, because he saw he didn't have to hold it so tightly. That he was suffering just because he was holding it tightly. And if he just paid attention to his suffering, to his need to control it all, he could do it in a more relaxed, open way. More relaxed, open way. Mahayana attitude, non-dualistic attitude. So I met with a guy also out there. I met with people who wanted to have one-to-ones with a teacher. And, you know, I'm a big deal because I'm from somewhere else. Someone from someone else comes in and they're a big deal. So I got to really be somebody out there. And I came back to being nobody here. But being somebody is being nobody, and being nobody is being somebody. So don't get wigged out on this. This is just to come back to who we are.
Right.
Come back to who we are. Where we are, as we are. So anyway, people wanted to have one-to-one meetings with me, even at places they weren't supposed to, because I'm the outside teacher. Maybe can help them in a way the inside teacher can't. So one person came and he said, he was more than 50, and he said, oh, he just got through a divorce a year ago, and this last year he didn't know about online dating. He'd never even gone online before, but he was going online. He'd gone online to four different sites. He had all these different dates online and then offline. He went on and on about all the things he'd done. And I said, I bet you're tired. He said, I'm exhausted. Well, I'm not his teacher, so I didn't say much to him. I just listened. But if I was his teacher, I would help him try to stay with the suffering that he's trying to get away from by doing all that stuff. He really needs to be feeling sad. He really needs to be with feeling sad. He really needs to be grieving. He really needs to be with that. But he's trying to protect himself by doing all this stuff. All this stuff. Instead of just being with his suffering. And we can all do that. When we're sad, we can be with our sadness. When we're feeling lonely, we can be with our loneliness. That's Mahayana attitude. The Mahayana attitude. We can have action steps too. But the action steps don't need to cover up our Mahayana attitude like a wetsuit so we don't feel. So not to have an answer when you're just bereft and your spouse has left you after 30 years is okay. Not knowing what to do is okay. Even if your spouse has not left you. And you're just having a problem, you don't know what to do, can you just be okay with that? Just be okay with that? Just settle into it? Just breathe with your kind mind, your open heart? So that's basically what I want to say today. Let's do this practice of the elders. The practice of the elders, the meditation practice, the simplifying our lives practice, the slowing down our lives practice, the trying to be compassionate to ourselves and others practice, the aspiring to settle into the silence which we barely even recognize practice. But let's do it with a Mahayana attitude, with an attitude that we're nobody, and since we're nobody, we're everything. We're the whole ocean. This little tiny wave with all this agitation is the whole ocean. The whole ocean. And we can embrace our moments. We can embrace our suffering. But it's not even that we embrace it. In Mahayana, it just embraces itself. Just embraces itself. So we're taken care of. We're taken care of. So I'm going to end with another quote from my first teacher. Each of you is perfect as you are. That's our Mahayana attitude. We're perfect as we are. And you could all use a little improvement. That's our Theravadin practice. We could all use a little improvement. We could all use a little improvement. So that's what I want to say for this morning, and there's maybe 5 minutes for any comments or questions or concerns. Comments, questions, concerns, stories, songs.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
I would really love to hear more about how your Zen practice led you to go to the homeless camp.
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's a little hard to know because you just know about your life. So my life as a Zen practitioner has, from when I started to now, has meant that I've been more willing to be vulnerable and able to just feel people's sadness, their bereftness more, and feel connected to their sadness, their bereftness. So all I can say is that I think that Zen practice makes us more sensitized to other people's suffering, and that then we just want to be with them, even if it's scary. We want to support them, even if it's awkward. It's hard for me to talk about it, except that my wife says to me that she's glad she didn't know me before I started Zen practice. She said, she didn't say that lately, but she always used to say that, because she used to hear about what I was like. Of course, I'm still like that sometimes. You know, I'm not perfect. I try to do my practice with the elders. But also, we become more sensitized, more open, more empty of our own stuff, and more open to suffering. If we're not, we waste our psychic energy trying to fix everything. And so we can't, then we have to keep people suffering away because it's too much for us. We can't really fix it. But if we forget trying to fix it, just open up, then we can actually help them by learning how to be in the home. Finally, I learned how to be in the homeless camps. I went 10 times before I learned how. Just to be there. That bad moment became a good moment because they're just human beings. They're hungover. They didn't get their fix the night before. But they're offering me cold coffee. Gee, that's for them to offer me cold coffee and then apologizing because it's cold? Wow. And I want to help. This is our bodhisattva. This is a bodhisattva practice that we're doing in Mahayana. We're bodhisattvas in Mahayana because we have a Mahayana attitude. But we don't know. I don't know. Really. Somebody else? Anything else? Anybody? Yeah.
I'm thinking about a moment in your talk where you talked about something that reminded me of something that Wanda said some weeks ago, which is about holding plans lightly.
Uh-huh.
And that's something that I really struggle with.
Uh-huh.
The notion of making a plan and then not completely fixing all of your expectations on it. And it's the point that when it doesn't go away, I don't think making plans and holding lightly is amazing.
Yeah, so you're saying that's hard for you.
Yeah.
And that's hard for all of us. The more we get invested in our plans, the more we get invested in the way we want things to be, and we have a good, well-articulated plan, the harder it is. The harder it is. So that's the human situation. But we can see through our still mind and our open heart that the plan is a map of this territory. And we can be in the territory and not fixated on the map. And it takes practice. That's why we do this Theravada practice, this practice of the elders, over and over and over. For 5 years, for 10 years, for 80 years, for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, for 80 minutes. That's the time. But we can do it. That's our aspiration. So thank you. Thank you.